Thank you so much for coming. The annual African Studies lecture is an opportunity to invite a leading speaker on Africa and for us to gain new perspectives. Last year we had Wallace Yinka, and he's been nominated as the Professor of Poetry. I believe the result was made known at 4 o'clock this afternoon. I don't know if anybody knows what's happened. This year we are privileged to have Winnie Byanyima, who is Executive Director of Oxfam International. Winnie was born into a political family in Uganda, trained as an engineer at the University of Manchester, and joined Museveni's struggle to free Uganda from the Obote regime. She's been an ambassador, an MP, has worked in the African Union, in UNDP, and in 2013 joined Oxfam. Oxfam is a remarkable institution, perhaps the leading global charity campaigning to provide emergency assistance to combat poverty and to address inequality. It's so much with us, especially in Oxford, and it's extraordinary that a small town like this, small city like this, could generate an organisation like Oxfam. It's so much with us that perhaps we take it for granted, but it's a truly remarkable organisation and is now headed by a truly remarkable executive director who can command global attention. And this was nowhere so clear as in Oxfam's recent major campaign to focus on global inequality and rising inequality within countries. It's so difficult to command media attention. The press is so febrile and jumps from one issue to another, and especially to violence. But for a couple of months, inequality was at the top of the global agenda, and Oxfam and Winnie were key people in making it so. And it's particularly valuable for us to welcome Winnie, because we hope it will cement links between Oxfam, African Studies, and the university. I want to thank my colleagues Nick Cheeseman and Miles Lama, who've run workshops over 2 years with Oxfam. This year, the workshop was focused on inequality, and it's arising out of that that we've asked Winnie to deliver the annual lecture. Through her experience and through her stature, she's in a unique position to set agendas. Winnie is deeply immersed in African issues and equally has a broad global view, and we're very glad that you've accepted our invitation. Winnie will talk on the theme, Is Africa Rising? A Personal View. Thank you.
When I thought about how I wanted to start this lecture, I told myself, Winnie, don't be an Afro-pessimist. Yes, I head up Oxfam, and I talk about poverty every day. But above all, I'm an African girl who's proud of her roots, proud of my family, proud of my country, and proud of my continent. I'm proud of what Africa has achieved. Economists and business leaders have reason to use the phrase Africa rising. Africa is home to 7 of the 10 fastest growing economies in the world. Many African countries are moving from low income to middle income status. We are closing the gap on levels of primary education and on reducing child mortality. All this is very welcome. But as I was preparing this lecture, I kept seeing a vision in front of me. On my television screen, on newspaper front pages, I kept seeing the stern, resolute faces of people, of young people, crammed onto boats and drifting in the sea, risking their lives and leaving everything behind, desperate to reach European shores just to be a migrant in a foreign country, and all too often drowning. Many of these boat people come from African countries. They come from Somalia, from Eritrea, from Mali, from Nigeria, and further south. They are overwhelmingly young. They are loved by their families who have paid to send them. Or they are ambitious young people and they have earned and saved money themselves. They are the fighters who want to succeed. And so it breaks my heart. Because how can we talk about Africa rising when some of its most promising people are drowning? So I hope that as I speak about Africa now and my hopes for Africa's future, you will hear the real pride in my voice, but you will also hear the realism and the pain that I have. I want to frame my talk today around three themes: inequality, power, and risk. Inequality, because the global inequality crisis is reflected in Africa too. Oxfam has calculated that just 80 people in the world have the same wealth as the poorest 3.5 billion, the poorest half of the world. Now, the World Bank has recently issued another statistic and said that just 10 people in Africa, 10, count them on my fingers, have the same wealth as the poorest half of the population. That's over half a billion people. Think about that. I want to talk about power because so much inequality is caused by the capture of political and economic power by elites. This is true across the world, where market fundamentalist principles are best seen as a project to transfer wealth and resources from those at the bottom to those at the top. As the basis for structural adjustment, market liberalization principles were certainly effective in increasing poverty, hunger, and inequality in Africa. By 2013, across the continent, an extra 50 million people were undernourished compared to 1990 and 1992, and thanks to structural adjustment. And in Africa, the capture of power by elites has been the story in too many post-independence states. All too often, patronage, cronyism, corruption have created a corrosive circular relationship between wealth and power, which leaves ordinary Africans in poverty and powerless. I also want to talk about risk, because asking the question, who shoulders the most risk, is often the most important indicator we have to understand where power lies and why inequality is growing. This is true whether you're looking at development projects or analyzing private sector value chains or tracking investments or applying it to some of our most fundamental global challenges such as climate change. So this inequality of risk is what I feel most strongly when I see those young people induced to risk drowning in the Mediterranean Sea, whilst the global investors I meet in Davos talk in swashbuckling terms about frontier markets, and they moralize on the duty of governments to help them de-risk their investments. Who's really taking risk? I believe that until we stop placing global risks onto the most vulnerable people on the planet, namely poor sub-Saharan African women, until we start valuing risk differently and put human life before the stock value of multinational companies, and until we replace too big to fail with a determination to protect the interests of ordinary people, the inequality crisis will just continue to spread. But I said I was not going to be a pessimist, and I won't be, because in this picture is also Africa's greatest strength, the resilience of its people. Let us consider the history of the continent of Africa. 4 centuries of slave trade, 1 century of colonialism, and now we are looking back at just 60 years of independence. There are continents where such a history led to indigenous people being almost completely wiped out. This is not so for Africa. In contrast, Africa's working age population is expected to double in the next 25 years to 1 billion people, surpassing both China and India. That is strength. 1 billion productive, resourceful, increasingly educated young men and women. Of course, we also know that the move to independence has been a very rocky road. The colonial legacy must take part of the blame here, and the decisions and the power structures that were left behind. But there were also weaknesses of post-independence leaders and the willingness of elites to capture the new states. My own family knows this as well as any. My father was a school teacher. He was not motivated by power, but inspired by the promise of a new nation, inspired by the independence movement across Africa, inspired by the resilience of the Ugandan people themselves. He was persuaded to leave the classroom and to represent our home area in the Ugandan parliament. He was proud to be part of a democracy in Africa. We felt very much part of an independence movement across the continent. But Uganda's independence was a false start. Before long, all but 5 members of my father's opposition party had been bribed or bullied into joining the party of government. Finally, his party was banned, leaving Uganda as a one-party dictatorship, which then fell into military rule, the rule of Idi Amin. Being a schoolgirl under Idi Amin, and in that picture, it was taken 1 week after Idi Amin took power. I turned 12 and Idi Amin took power. And for the next 9 years, the brutal regime of Idi Amin shaped my life. Being a schoolgirl under Idi Amin, I learned the stark difference between those who had power and those who shouldered risk. Idi Amin would wake up in the morning and declare a new law on the radio, supposedly inspired by his dreams. He would ban lipstick today. Tomorrow he would ban wigs. Another day he would ban miniskirts. Another day he would ban long skirts with a slit on the side, and so on and so on. The nuns who taught us at school built strong walls around our school to protect us. But every day, my friends and I would walk to school with the risk of being spotted by a government soldier. You could be accused of wearing a miniskirt or a long skirt with a slit or whatever. But the more constant threat to us was of being simply taken away by a soldier to be his wife. There was no appeal. No courts worked. And yet we took this risk. We got our education. Ordinary people worked, helped each other to be resilient against such a tyrannical regime. Similarly, at home, my father continued to take risks, and our home became a house of resistance for people whose rights were being denied. Women whose land was grabbed, young men thrown out of jobs for not supporting the regime, fathers whose daughters had been taken away by soldiers, and so on. In the end, we Ugandans, we organized, we fought, and we won against oppression and dictatorship. So while Uganda is not what we would celebrate as a true democracy, it is stable and is beginning to deliver for its people. So let's move back now to the present day and examine the claim we are seeing. Is it true that Africa is rising? A few weeks ago, I was at the World Economic Forum on Africa in Cape Town. In this beautiful city, amongst the luxury hotels and booming restaurant businesses, I heard one dominant narrative. In the words of South African President Jacob Zuma, the African continent is open for business. This is, of course, true to some extent. Over the past decade, Africa has been among the world's fastest growing continents, with an annual growth rate of 5%, more actually. In 2014, the IMF estimated that Ethiopia was the world's fastest growing economy. Foreign direct investment has expanded more than 30-fold in the last 20 years. Much of this growth and investment could be attributed to the global demand for natural resources and commodity prices. But it would be a mistake to see that as a whole picture. Tourism, telecoms, banking, transport are all attracting investment and driving growth in Africa. Furthermore, we have seen real progress in the sphere of human development and in moving towards the Millennium Development Goals. In sub-Saharan Africa, 41% of fewer mothers die in childbirth than they did 2 decades ago. That's progress. And since 2000, the region has doubled the rate at which child mortality is declining. This is one of the most sensitive indicators of poverty in a society. So while across the continent we are seeing more policy and political stability, whilst there's still huge variation on that continent, we should look to Botswana, to Senegal, to Kenya, Benin, Ghana, Zambia and others are strong examples of progress. And yet, almost 1 out of every 2 Africans still lives in extreme poverty. This is more than 4 times the world average. And whilst the proportion of those living in poverty is declining, the absolute number is projected to increase by over 50 million by 2030. It's the region with the highest prevalence of people going hungry and where, in contrast to global trends, the total number of people in hunger is still increasing. And of course, women are hit hardest. In sub-Saharan Africa, they earn an average 30% less than men. So how do we marry these two pictures? Africa is growing. Africa is rising. There are 16 billionaires living in sub-Saharan Africa. 16. But so are the number of African people living in poverty. That's also rising. So the question to ask, therefore, is Africa is rising, but rising for whom? Rising for whom? This brings me to explore the first of my 3 themes. That of inequality. 6 African countries are among the top most unequal countries in the world, with South Africa being the most unequal country in the world. South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Zambia, Central African Republic, and Lesotho. This is deeply undesirable for several reasons. First, high levels of inequality are slowing poverty reduction efforts. We now have an increasing understanding that economic inequality severs the link between growth and poverty reduction. A study from the World Bank has found that in countries with very low income inequality, such as several in Eastern Europe, every 1% of economic growth reduces poverty by 4%. in countries without very high income inequality. In countries with high inequality, such as Angola or Namibia, growth had essentially no impact on poverty. Zambia grew by an average of 3% every year between 2004 and 2010, pushing Zambia into the ranks of middle-income countries. Despite this growth, the number of people living below the $25 poverty line grew from 65% in 2003 to 74% in 2010. Distribution of income can have an effect on a wider set of poverty outcomes too. Take the example of Bangladesh and Nigeria. Both are now middle-income countries, moving towards middle income. Bangladesh is the poorer of the two, but it is far more equal than Nigeria. Child mortality rates in Nigeria are 3 times higher than those in Bangladesh. It's the children who bear the brunt of inequality. It's the children. The fact is that if African countries continue on their current growth trajectory with no changes in levels of income inequality, then the continent's poverty rate won't fall below 3%, which is what the World Bank is defining as ending poverty, until 2075, not 2030. Secondly, economic inequality compounds gender inequality. When I think about the position of women in Africa, I think of that woman, Jane, and her story. Jane is now 75 years old. She's my mother's goddaughter. She attended every one of my mother's births, including my own. At 16, she was married, not for love, not through her own choice, and she was not even a first wife. Her husband married her for her labor. He needed more help on the land. Here, she lived a hard life. It was hard work. She was a successful farmer, but all her products went to her husband. And she lost 3 of her own children before the age of 5 through illnesses and diseases that she would have been able to combat if she had not been so poor. Her husband died in 2005. Before this, I had helped her to build a small house on her husband's land. Under Ugandan law, she should be able. Now she wants to do the natural thing in the world, which is to leave her little house to one of her sons, her eldest son. And under Ugandan law, she should be able to do this. She has a right to the land of her husband and the house she built it on. However, as a second wife, tradition dictates that she cannot, that the land belongs to the son of the first wife. So when she came to me asking for the money to buy the land back from her stepson, I challenged her. Why pay for what is already yours? You've tilled this land for 30, 40 years. It's yours by law. Claim it. The answer tells you a lot about the legacy of discrimination against women. She would not stand up for what is rightfully hers. Her life is regulated by tradition and custom, not the formal law of Uganda written in the constitution and the law books. She dares not step out of this as the consequences of conflict with the family, the stigma, are too much to bear. At best, she would be seen as a woman that does not respect custom. At worst, there could be violence in her family. It's still the case today that many women in Africa are like Jane. They still fight to earn a living for themselves and their families against rules which hold them back. They are not allowed to own land or to inherit. the wage gap between men and women is higher in more economically unequal societies. And women shoulder the vast majority of the unpaid care burden. This creates a vicious cycle, as women living in poverty are more likely to lack the legal entitlements and the political power that they need to increase their income. I'll take you to a chart. This chart from Oxfam's recent report on inequality looks at the compounding impacts of inequality. It combines income, gender, and a comparison between rural and urban homes. It finds that the poorest 20% of Ethiopians are 3 times more likely to miss out on school than the wealthiest 20%. But when we consider the impact of gender inequality alongside urban-rural economic inequality, a much greater wedge is driven between the haves and the have-nots. The poorest rural women are almost 6 times more likely than the richest urban men to never attend school. And without a deliberate effort to address this injustice, gender injustice, the same will be true for their daughters and their granddaughters. This is because the third feature of economic inequality is that it undermines social mobility. In the US, nearly half of all children born to low-income parents will become low-income adults. So for these, the American dream is just that, a dream. Living in poverty in an unequal society is a miserable experience, but it's also clear that inequality is bad for all of us. I expect many of you have heard of Thomas Piketty's book, Capital in the 21st Century. This book has done so much to raise the issue of inequality as the preeminent challenge of our time. For those who have not read this rather large book, the central conclusion is that in capitalist societies, the rate of return on capital, on wealth, is greater than the economic growth rate. So the share of wealth going to labor is being left behind by the share of wealth going to capital. Because of the available data, Piketty focuses exclusively on the rich industrialized world. But it does lead me to question what African people would make of his conclusions. I'm sure many would recognize the idea that hard work and wealth are not linked. Wage inequality in Africa is growing as it is everywhere else. In South Africa, a platinum miner would need to work for 93 years just to earn the average CEO's annual bonus. 93 years. And if I was discussing Piketty's book with rural women and rural girls, for instance, they would tell me that there's very little relationship between hard work and any income at all. Piketty's book looks at GDP, and GDP fails to take into account the incredible amount of unpaid care work shouldered by women and girls in Africa. Women in sub-Saharan Africa spend 40 billion hours per year collecting water. Women and girls, I must keep saying. This is equivalent to a year's worth of labor by the entire workforce in France. Entire workforce in France, done by African women and girls, just collect water. This is before you put in collecting fuel wood as well, and before you put in the work in the field. 70% of Africa's homegrown food is produced by women, and women spend 3 to 5 times longer than men on domestic activities such as cooking, cleaning, caring for children. All this unpaid work contributes nothing to economic growth in the ways that we currently measure it. The problems with inequality are increasingly understood by policymakers, thankfully, we are witnessing a change in thinking in recent years, as inequality is no longer seen as the unfortunate price to pay for growth. In Davos, at the World Economic Forum, but also at the forum I was at in Africa this month, the quest for inclusive growth was a strong theme. And finding growth that delivers for all was the challenge left by Dr. Donald Kaberuka, who was here recently, we shared a panel here, as he stepped down from his role as president of the African Development Bank this year. So solutions are being discussed to tackle inequality, and there are solutions that make sense. Much inequality is found in resource-rich countries where the linkages between the extractive sector and the rest of the economy are weak. Encouraging an industrial base and manufacturing to add value to our natural resources would be essential for job creation. Likewise, investing in sectors like agriculture would reach the 75% of Africa's poor who live in rural areas, especially if this can be linked to demand from increasing urban populations. There's an undoubted need for infrastructure and better regional integration to improve trade within African economies. Technology is seen as an opportunity for African poverty reduction. The popular phrase leapfrogging, as policymakers hope that innovation by the private sector, telecoms, and decentralized energy will make up for poor infrastructure and lack of an industrial base in Africa. So an action is being taken to address the rights of women and girls. Africa has what is considered by many to be the best and most progressive women's rights policy instrument in the Protocol on the Rights of African Women. There is merit to all these solutions, and they should be pursued. But I'm concerned that these discussions are taking place without a strong analysis of the power dynamics which have led to this increasing inequality, or even a willingness to tackle those who benefit from the status quo. So let me move to my other two themes, those of power and risk. I want to start by taking you back to the picture of foreign direct investment flowing into Africa. And I want to temper this picture slightly. The UN Conference on Trade and Investment estimated that FDI flows into Africa were about $55 billion last year. This is what Zuma celebrates as Africa being open for business. In comparison to this, and on the basis of official projections, the flow of remittances bound for Africa will reach around $64 billion this year. $55 billion FDI, $64 billion remittances. In fact, official remittance flows to Africa as a whole have exceeded FDI since 2010. In sub-Saharan Africa, they actually match levels of aid spending. This is money sent home by ordinary migrant workers, including myself, helping to fund health, education, and rural livelihoods for millions of families. These are both important sums of money. But whilst business investment is feted, courted, and aided by governments, ordinary people face considerable difficulty in sending this money home, the remittances. ODI has calculated that African people pay a high price to get this investment to their loved ones. In fact, no region faces higher charges for remittance transfers. African migrants sending $200 home can expect to pay 12% in charges. The ODI also estimated that reducing charges to world average levels would increase the value transfers by about $1.8 billion annually, a huge sum of extra money for African people. Contrast this picture with the way the investment of large companies into Africa are treated. The talk is of frontier markets and investors and wealth creators. The emphasis is put on de-risking investment and an enabling environment for business. The World Bank now ranks countries through its Doing Business Index. Furthermore, there's an increasing trend for overseas aid money, aid that used to build classrooms and clinics, now is being used to hold the hand of private investors as they go into Africa. They need some help. This is seen as delivering value for money, that by spending some aid money that could go and buy vaccines to leverage private finance, aid can deliver more bang for its buck. The problem with this argument is that there's rarely enough done to ensure that these investments have any impact on poor people. And furthermore, there's also a big question mark over whether these private investors really need the aid money in the first place to make their investments viable, to make their profits. In a recent report, the European Court of Auditors found that the use of aid money to blend with private finance had no additional value in half the cases they investigated. In other words, the same amount of private finance would have been provided anyway, though the companies were, of course, very happy to receive aid money in support of their ventures. This comparison to me says a lot about how power changes the perception of risk in society. The investments of powerful companies are protected from failure, whilst the larger investments of ordinary people through their remittances are hit with a remittance super tax. The second point I want to make about financial flows is that for all this money flowing into Africa, far more flows out to the rest of the world. A recent report by the High-Level Panel on Illicit Financial Flows led by former South African President Thabo Mbeki found that in 2010 alone, 1 year, multinational companies were responsible for around $40 billion leaving the continent as a result of trade mispricing alone. Trade mispricing is just one of the tactics to avoid paying fair share of taxes by multinational companies doing business in Africa. Add to this the issue of generous tax breaks, incentives, tax holidays negotiated by multinational companies. On a panel here in Oxford, here in this room actually in January, Dr. Donald Kaberuka was reflecting on his time as finance minister of Rwanda and what it felt like to be on the receiving end of tax negotiations. He recounted, and I'm quoting him, "The multinational comes to you and says, we want to invest in your country, but we need a 5-year tax holiday and this long list of requirements. And by the way, we only have 6 hours and then our plane is taking us to your neighbor who will probably agree to all of our demands." That's how it goes. Precisely due to the secrecy surrounding companies' tax arrangements, it is impossible to get a full picture of the amount of money lost to Africa through tax dodging and through such harmful tax competition. But we can say with confidence that much of Africa's progress is only going back to benefit rich countries and their companies. This is only made possible because of the relative power position of multinationals. This includes their power in relation to African governments, desperate to attract investments, and their power in relation to the bodies setting global tax rules. When the OECD launched one of its consultations with stakeholders into global tax rules in 2013, almost 87% of the contributions came from the business sector. 87%. This is why Oxfam and other international NGOs are putting so much of our time into campaigning on tax. That's why we're doing it. If multinationals can run rings around our tax systems to avoid paying tax where they really earn their money, if countries continue to compete to offer the lowest tax rates and most beneficial tax deals to attract investors, then we'll continue in a spiral to the bottom. A tax war that means we cannot tackle poverty and inequality. And lastly, as we analyze power and risk in this picture of financial flows and investments, let's look at global supply chains. Companies are proud of creating employment in developing countries. But for that pride in job creation to be justified, those jobs must be of good quality. Unfortunately, we see that more and more economic value is going to executives and shareholders and less to workers. Bosses of British supermarkets, such as Tesco, enjoyed a quadrupling in pay from £1 million to over £4.2 million between 1999 and 2010. While garment workers from poor countries across the world have seen the real value of their wages go down. Oxfam has conducted some of our studies into value chains involving multinationals and local companies. We have found that all too often, work is not a route out of poverty, but is trapping people into poverty. In Malawi, where the tea industry has been going on for over 100 years, the wages of tea pickers were only about 37% of the estimated local living wage, not nearly enough for food, clothing, housing, and any other spending. In Kenya, we looked at the cut flowers and green beans sectors, which provide significant export value. Most jobs were poor quality on very low wages, especially for women. For every pound spent on cut flowers in the UK, the growers back in Kenya received just 7 pence. For a pound's worth of green beans, it was even lower, just 5 pence. If just 5 pence were added to a 4-pound bouquet of flowers in your local Asda, and I'm sure you buy 20-pound flower bouquets, wages for workers could be doubled. Adding just 5 pence to a bouquet of 4 pounds could double the wages of workers. It's clear to me, therefore, that any talk of inclusive growth in Africa from its political leaders must be accompanied with a willingness to tackle power and vested interests and help the poorest people to face the very real life and death risks which they face. And help the poorest people to mitigate or to reduce the risks that they face. But for all the injustice of the global financial system and its tendency to push risk towards the bottom, there's nothing compared to the risks posed to poor people than from a changing climate. Africa's future growth and human development rests to a great degree on agriculture. Yet climate change is a real threat to this. Even with global warming of less than 2 degrees centigrade by 2050, which is not where we are, total crop production in Africa could be reduced by 10%. Furthermore, climate change increases the frequency and intensity of extreme weather events with severe humanitarian consequences. The drought in 2011 affected over 13 million people and led to a famine in Somalia that killed over 250,000 people. No one event can be put down to climate change, but climatologists at the Met Office Hadley Center found that climate change is likely to have increased the risk of the drought occurring. Rising sea levels could threaten the coastal cities of Accra, Dar es Salaam, Lagos, all of them. New health threats could emerge. In each of these areas, it's the poor who will bear the brunt. The injustice of this, of course, is that people suffering the most from climate change have done least to cause it. Africa accounts for only 2.3 of global carbon emissions. It would take the average Ethiopian 240 years to register the same carbon footprint as an average American. And in response to this, developed countries continue to drag their feet. I attend the climate change negotiations every year. I find them there. They are playing international climate negotiations as if they are trade deals, using bluff and brinkmanship to ensure they don't commit to further emissions faster than their neighbors, rather than realizing the urgent need to meet a common threat and doing what the science demands. But Africa's leaders are also failing. They are failing to respond to climate change as they approach policy around their own economies. This is despite the fact that even the most conservative models suggest that African countries will face total costs relating to climate change of over 6% of GDP by the end of the century. So, the way we structure our economies, the way business, and therefore the way government perceives risks, fails to deal with this existential threat to Africa's poor. So, if we are going to address poverty, inequality, and climate change, the solutions can't be apolitical and technocratic. We have to rebalance power, and we must stop pushing the greatest risk down to those at the bottom. Governments have a role to play. It is governments that have the vital role of helping to take the risk out of the lives of the poor, not the lives of the richest. And democratic engagement is vital to rebalance power towards people. But look, too many elections in Africa simply give the impression, the semblance of sharing power, but don't deliver to the people. In fact, they deliver the same result continuously. Many presidents just keep coming back again and again. Crucially, the other elements of a functional democracy are also missing. They've only managed to have elections. That's the element they care about. And they predict it and get it the way they want. But freedom of expression, freedom of information, freedom of assembly, independence of the judiciary, these are missing. Look at what happened in Burundi recently, or maybe I shouldn't bore you with that. But a leader insists on his right to stand in a presidential election because he says he was not elected the first term, he was only appointed by parliament, therefore he must run again. And people go out on the street and say, no, that's not how we interpret our constitution. And they get killed. So, one man's ambition results in the death of young people on the streets. My own journey from that schoolgirl to now has taken me through many roles, from aeronautical engineering, which I studied, to politics, to being a member of parliament, working for the African Union, for the UN. I'm proud of achievements in all, but it is with Oxfam that I feel I can do the most to challenge the elite capture of power that lies at the root of so much poverty and inequality. The solutions to this imbalance of power, this abuse of power, lies with organized citizens. Organized citizens working together to challenge injustice. I'm not just talking about NGOs here. I'm talking about faith groups, community groups, unions, workers, cooperatives, human rights organizations, the whole array of organizations of civil society. The vibrancy and power of people working together will change the power of the 1%. I'm proud to work for Oxfam, precisely because we support African civil society to assert itself and claim its space and claim its role. As an international NGO, we also have an opportunity to link African social justice movements with other regions. We can link movements and struggles in Asia, in Latin America, in the Arab world, in a way that builds solidarity across countries. Through such solidarity, the excluded can work together to increase their power. And my optimism remains rooted in the resilience of ordinary African people. You know, we often say in Africa that we have a sense of common ancestry and common destiny, and that this has brought us far. We feel this strongly, and this binds our people together. We often call each other brother, sister. We don't have friends. We have brothers and sisters. This helps us. This leads us through, and it will continue to do so. So let me end by looking ahead to the future for Africa. I will paint you my picture. Africa is the youngest region in the world, and of course the oldest as well. By 2030, we will see this demographic dividend of young people enter the workforce. By then, the reforms to the global tax system will have allowed African countries to halve their tax gap, raising over $112 billion extra dollars. Spurred by active civil society groups and the direction set by the Sustainable Development Goals, this money is directed at health, at education, and at social protection. It is spent on agriculture, in infrastructure, to link up and light up our continent. This has enabled young people to create products and services and enterprising solutions which will solve the problems of poverty across the continent. In cities from Nairobi to Accra, these young urban workers are fed by Africa's booming agriculture, where small farmers are able to respond to the needs of urban areas and to resist the encroachment of global agribusiness. Nairobi becomes the Silicon Valley of Africa as other cities emerge as centers for technological innovation. Africa is not just a continent of consumers, but a contributor of innovation and global knowledge. Climate finance is flowing to Africa, protecting the poorest as they seek to adapt to global warming, but also supporting African businesses. African culture is thriving, and there's a true African renaissance. 20 heads of state are women, including from previously conflict-affected states. African universities are hotbeds of innovation and political activism, as young students are inspired by the declining power of the old elites to debate and to create the future. In every country, the gap between the poor and the rich is decreasing, leading to stable growth and a decline in conflict in our region. And no one is getting into boats to cross the Mediterranean. Thank you very much.